On Tuesday, leaders of countries from around the world will meet at the United Nations for a day-long summit on climate change. The goal is to get some momentum behind the effort to create a new treaty to address global warming. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris will be covering the summit and joins us now. Richard, remind us who called this meeting and why.
Well, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations called this meeting because things are going really, really poorly in the global climate talks. A couple of years ago in Bali, everyone got together and agreed that we should have a new climate treaty by December of 2009, and they're meeting in Copenhagen, barely 3 months away, and basically the whole thing is a mess. There's almost nothing. There's very, very poor momentum into that meeting. And Ban Ki-moon said, this is a huge problem. We got to do something about it.
So what kind of agreement are they looking for?
Well, at the United Nations talk, it will be inspirational, essentially. Let's get people to agree, yeah, this is a big problem. Yeah, we have to take things seriously. We have to agree that the developing world needs more money. We have to agree that the developed world needs to do something. We need to agree sort of on broad concepts. But it's not a negotiating session per se, but I think Ban Ki-moon hoped that by pulling everyone together and getting world leaders to give speeches, that that would give a little momentum to the underlings who actually have to go to Copenhagen and make everything work.
Can you be a little specific about the conflicts between developing nations and nations that have already developed, specifically like items they're going to be talking about?
Yeah, well, the developing world would like clean energy technology, something other than coal, maybe wind or solar or something like that. They're saying, we haven't even had a chance to develop a lot of these technologies. We need help developing them and developing them cleanly. And the problem is with a global recession right now, there's not much money to be had, and that's one real huge issue. Another major conflict is between the United States and China, because China has basically not agreed to reduce its emissions. And in fact, it says, before we do, we want to see the United States have some incredibly dramatic emissions reductions. And so they're taking a very hard line. The U.S. is responsible for about a quarter of the world's emissions. And as we know, the U.S. Congress has not figured out what to do about this. And so it's hard to go to an international talk and say, well, we haven't figured out what we're going to do domestically, and then have any credible position in the international talk. So Europe is mad at the United States for dragging its feet along those lines. So, I mean, these are enormous
political, economic, environmental questions to be asked.
Really, really hard problems. And it's not surprising that in 2 years we haven't solved them all. But yeah, but that was the deadline they set for themselves.
Right. But there's 3 months until Copenhagen. And you know, you said they're going to start setting out like what they're going to try to do on Tuesday. From what you're saying, it doesn't sound too likely that there will be an agreement in 3 months in Copenhagen. What happens if there isn't?
Yeah, well, I think that there's got to be some sort of agreement is the hope. I think the expectations are beginning to be scaled back. I think the hope for a full new climate treaty is really unrealistic. But the question is how to make Copenhagen not a complete disaster, because if that's a disaster, then the odds are that countries will decide, oh, this problem is just too hard, and we'll go away and think about something else for a while. And that's obviously the worst possible outcome.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, Tuesday at the United Nations, there is a day-long summit on climate change. Richard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Every year, almost 3 million people across the globe are infected with HIV, and half of them are younger than 25. The United Nations cultural arm, UNESCO, is trying to cut those numbers and reach other health goals by creating new guidelines for sex education. Those guidelines won't be finalized until October, but they're already kicking up controversy. Eleanor Beardsley has a story from UNESCO's home base in Paris.
A sign above the elevator in the lobby of UNESCO's headquarters in Paris says, "Let's cultivate peace." That's not always easy for an organization dealing with the cultures and mores of 193 different nations. The latest fracas is over a set of sex education guidelines that are meant to help reduce the spread of AIDS, sexually transmitted diseases, and unwanted pregnancies throughout the world. Mark Richmond is UNESCO's global coordinator of HIV/AIDS projects. He says there is a desperate need for better sex education in schools.
Only about 40% of young people between 15 and 24 have a clear and accurate understanding of how HIV and AIDS is transmitted. And that's appalling, especially since 45% of all new infection are among young people between 15 and 24. And in that circumstance, we really have to try to do something to improve the knowledge level and the awareness.
Richmond says the guidelines are careful to emphasize the different psychological, spiritual, social, economic, and cultural dimensions that surround sex and sexuality. UNESCO says there have been no objections so far to the sex curriculum from conservative Islamic countries, But there has been a strong reaction from American conservatives. A draft copy of the guidelines placed on UNESCO's website prompted an outcry in some sections of the media. UN report advocates teaching masturbation to five-year-olds, was the headline on FoxNews.com. New UNESCO sex education guidelines call on children to promote abortions, announced a LifeNews.com article. Richmond calls such allegations false and a distortion of the facts to grab headlines. However, he does admit the guidelines recommend starting sex education early.
It's no good teaching young people after they've started becoming sexually active. To have a comprehensive approach to this issue, you can't start teaching this at the age of 12. You need to starting earlier, letting children get a better understanding of things. It has to be obviously modulated according to their age.
Chad Hills is a sexual health analyst with the Christian group Focus on the Family. He says his group has a number of objections to the guidelines, and not just about sex education for young children. Hill says the main problem is that UNESCO is attempting to treat the symptoms of sexual ills instead of attacking the root cause, behavior.
The safest and healthiest context for sexuality is within a faithful, monogamous, heterosexual relationship called marriage that lasts a lifetime. When we undercut that message by handing out condoms and telling the lie that you can go out and have safe sex, just wear a condom, or just use birth control, you know, nothing could be further from the truth.
UNESCO's Richmond says sex education is the best way to change risky behavior. And he says many countries have been asking the UN to provide advice on sex education for young people. Richmond believes the guidelines could help reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, especially in places where birth control is not even an option. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. 90 years ago, a talented group of authors, critics, poets, and journalists began to meet for lunch at the Algonquin Hotel in New York. They became known as the Vicious Wits and collectively as the Algonquin Roundtable. Since then, plays, musicals, and movies have been written about their lives, and their works have become the stuff of doctoral dissertations. So why do we need another book about them? Nat Benchley, grandson of one member of the so-called Vicious Circle, writer Robert Benchley, answers that in a new book, The Lost Algonquin Roundtable, and Nat Benchley joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So why do we need another book about them?
Well, partially because the mere phrase, the Algonquin Roundtable, has been misappropriated over the years. It was used in a book a couple of years ago that had almost nothing to do with the Roundtable. The picture on the cover was of Dorothy Parker and five men, none of whom were members of the Roundtable. And it has sort of lost its meaning, lost its way. And what we really wanted to do was get back to discovering why these people were famous in the first place. So we started doing some research into what these people were writing before they became famous and found some wonderful material. I had found some when I was researching my one-man show about Robert, writings that he did in 1917 for the New York Tribune.
Your grandfather, Robert Benchley, you write, tried to hide his erudition in pursuit of his image as an idler. Why did he do that?
Because it was part of his self-deprecation. It was one of those things he really couldn't help. He was very bright, very well read. He read about five newspapers a day. He read German texts in the original German. But he kept them hidden because he thought it would look pretentious and because his reputation was as a partier and an idler who could never get any work done.
Mm. Dorothy Parker is one of the more famous of the circle, and she has more of her work in print today than she did when she was alive. Why do you think that is?
Well, she is very clever, very bright, and her work reads well, particularly in excerpts, either in short stories or poems. You don't really tend to sit down. She never finished a novel, so you don't sit down and read her cover to cover. She's very good for picking up and putting down, as is Robert Benchley, as are many of the others. She is, I believe, the only one of the members who is still in print because she was a brilliant wordsmith. Unfortunately, the human side of it was a little less pleasant. I talked to a lot of people who had known her, and every single one of them said, I'm not real sure why people hung out with her much, because personally she was not very pleasant to be around.
We remember the famous names, Parker, Benchley, Edna Ferber, Harpo Marx, but there's many who are virtually unknown, and one of them is Deems Taylor. Who is he?
Deems Taylor was the Dean of American Music He was a charming, funny, witty guy who was a brilliant musician. And these days, he is largely remembered for having been the narrator of Fantasia, but in the 20s, he had reviews, he had radio shows. I remember my father talking about him when I was young. He also was the first president of ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And it's one of those things, as Kevin points out in the book, people who fall out of print fall out of memory. And Deems Taylor didn't write a lot, but even so, as a musician, he has unfortunately been lost to memory, and we have a couple of bits of his in here.
You have a review he wrote, and it was the first performance of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And he says, Mr. Gershwin's piece possessed at least two themes of genuine musical worth.
Well, and again, you see, these critics, they could be so gentle, and yet they could really drop a hammer on someone with very clever wordplay. There's one in here that Robert wrote when he wasn't even sure if the play would be open by the time his review was printed, so he reviewed the program instead. Mm-hmm. He reviewed the circus. He had a review once of a play. He didn't much like the actor, but he couldn't bring himself to say anything nasty about him, so he said, while I'm sure this gentleman is someone I would be pleased to meet personally, nature has secured me from being excited when he comes on stage. He just, in many ways, they didn't like to really hit hard on plays and particularly performers.
What meaning do you think these works have to a contemporary audience?
My hope is that, as people like E.B. White and William Shawn have stated many times, that people who read good writing will learn to write better, and they will learn to put more substance in their writing. And I believe what these works do is show the power of really well-chosen words to affect criticism, to entertain, to illuminate. And these days, there is so much blather being put out there. I have to say, I take exception with one of our lead bloggers who said that all unfiltered thought should be put out there for everybody to see. I think that's a waste of time. And I think if you consider good writers like these who chose their words carefully and honed them, read enough of that and you'll learn to write better yourself. And then published works will be, I believe, more pleasant to read.
I'd like you to end with a short poem by Franklin Pierce Adams, the newspaper columnist who is called the Dean of the Round Table. And he wrote it in the last issue of The World, the paper folded in 1931. And it's kind of interesting today with so many newspapers folding. It's called Journalism, and it's on page 212.
Journalism's a shrew and a scold. I like her. She makes you sick, she makes you old. I like her. She's daily trouble, storm, and strife. She's love and hate and death and life. She ain't no lady. She's my wife. I like her.
The poem Journalism, written by Franklin Pierce Adams, read by Nat Benchley. Benchley is the co-editor with Kevin C. Fitzpatrick of the Lost Algonquin Roundtable, humor, fiction, journalism, criticism, and poetry from America's most famous literary circle. Nat Benchley joined us from New York. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Leanne.
If you've ever booked a hotel reservation on the travel website Expedia, then you might have recently received a class action settlement notice in your email inbox. You should think twice before deleting it. Joe Brancatelli is a business travel writer, and he's on the line to explain what this proposed settlement means for consumers. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Leanne. Nice to be with you.
Good to hear from you, because you know what? I actually received one of those email notices. So what did Expedia do wrong, and what does the settlement require?
Well, the settlement doesn't actually require all that much, and for people who haven't been informed by email, they can go to servicesfeessettlement.com or just Google Expedia settlement. What it basically came down to was Expedia hid their own service fees and claimed they were part of taxes. But Expedia was caught. They've, after first denying any issue, have now entered into this class action settlement.
Yeah, the settlement has specific dates on it. What is it, January 10th, 2001 through June 11th, 2008? And is it just You know, like standalone hotel reservations? What if you got a package from them?
No, apparently it was just an Expedia standalone hotel reservation, largely within the period that you just mentioned, but also there were some other exemptions on the time frame.
So what do I and other consumers get out of the settlement?
Well, there'll be a couple of pennies in cash, if you wish cash, or double that in Expedia credit if you wish to do business with Expedia again. As you know, Leanne, these class action settlements always do much better for the lawyers than the people who've been in the class and been wronged, but it's better than nothing.
Hmm.
And it is, I would like to say it's a warning shot across the bow of travel marketers who do these kind of things, but sadly, travel marketing is probably the third oldest profession.
Well, you know, elaborate on that. I mean, this kind of deceptive practice, it's not an isolated incident. It's actually a wider problem in the industry.
It is a raging problem, and it's much more of a problem now as airlines especially have begun to break out what things we used to consider part of their standard offering that have now gone what the industry calls a la carte.
Why are these practices so prevalent in the travel industry? What's going on?
This is a very low margin business with very high fixed cost, and frankly, they've told the traveler to only buy the cheapest fare because, frankly, there's always a great fare out there. So people are trained to look at only the lowest fare and buy only the lowest fare. So then the airlines try different ways to get you to buy ups and extras.
So how do travelers then protect themselves when you know, we're making travel reservations online?
The trick you need to do now is just be aware that the price you're looking at is not the price you pay.
Joe Brancatelli is a business travel writer, and he runs a website for business travelers called Joe Sent Me. The 61st Annual Primetime Emmy Awards for Excellence in Television will be given out tonight. Less noticed were the Creative Arts Emmys awarded last Saturday. In the new category of Short Format Live Action Entertainment Program, the Golden Statue went to a show that was created specifically to be seen online.
For every day, there is a night. For every world, there is an underworld. And for every hero, there's this guy.
What?
Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog is a 43-minute web musical about the life of an aspiring supervillain played by Neil Patrick Harris, who incidentally is the host of tonight's Emmy broadcast. The creator of Dr. Horrible is Joss Whedon. This is his first Emmy award, although he had been nominated for his other creation, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Joss Whedon is on the phone from his office in Los Angeles. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
This is the first Emmy to be awarded to a web program. Did the nomination and the win come as a surprise to you?
A little bit. Didn't expect to win an Emmy for something that had never been on TV.
Yeah. You created this during the writer's strike, right?
That's right.
What were you trying to prove?
Well, I was trying to prove very simply that people could create stuff that didn't look like it was shot in their backyard, that wasn't a cute kitten, that we could do this without the giant corporations who are squashing us under their heel, and that everybody could get paid.
Well, you said you had the idea before you decided to go and do it for the web. What exactly was the inspiration for the plot and these characters and the fact that you wanted to make a musical?
Well, I had thought about doing a sort of musical podcast as a way to just start writing songs again. Then I came up with the character of Dr. Horrible and thought, well, here's a guy whose diary or blog would be fun to have. And when the strike hit, a lot of us started talking about creating content for the web, and I had a few meetings up in Silicon Valley, and I had a few things to pitch that I thought would be very friendly to them, and then I had, and here's something you'll never buy, a musical about a supervillain. And when it became clear that those people weren't really going to come through during the strike, I just, you know, hunkered down and raised the money myself, and then sort of really fleshed it into the piece it was with my brothers and my future sister-in-law who wrote it with me.
How did the actors that you approached, I mean, Neil Patrick Harris and Nathan Fillion, who was in Firefly, mm-hmm. one of your other creations, I mean, when you approached them with the idea that, hey, we're going to do a web musical, what was their reaction?
their reaction was to say yes before I could even tell them what it was about.
The day Dr. Horrible premiered online, the internet crashed.
That is the way it must always be remembered by America, because we were too cheap to pay for enough bandwidth is not quite as legendary sounding.
Well, you're working on the second season of Dollhouse.
Yes.
So you are busy, but there's not going to be a second season for Dr. Horrible?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a season, but we definitely want to pursue the story more. That's an absolute. We've talked about different ways to do that, whether it would be another, you know, three-act, 45-minute piece, or whether it would be something bigger, what medium it would be. And right now we're just writing with the idea of, well, what's the next thing we'd like to see these characters do? Where we see them do it, we'll figure out later.
Joss Whedon, who just won his first Emmy Award for his online creation, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. The web musical is now available on DVD. Joss, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So that's, you know, coming along.